Al Britton versus Commonwealth, Daniel Yates, Michael Robinson, Appellants Counsel, Toby J. Heitens, Solicitor General, Martine Ciccone, Deputy Solicitor General, Michelle Callen, Deputy Solicitor General, Jessica Samuels, Assistant Solicitor General, Zachary Glubiak, John Marshall Fellow, Victoria Pearson, Deputy Attorney General, Stacey Sessoms, Assistant Attorney General, Appellees Counsel.
The appellant may begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Danny Yates. Michael Robinson and I, from the law firm of Venable, represent Mr. DaVinci Albritton, the appellant in this matter. Before I begin, may I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
All right.
First, Your Honors, on behalf of my client, I would like to thank this court for granting this petition for appeal. It's not every day that an incarcerated litigant's handwritten pro se petition leads to a full-blown merits argument before this court. But it's also not every day that a trial court ignores substantial conflicting evidence and grants summary judgment without so much as a letter opinion or an oral ruling. Here, the trial court short-circuited my client's case, deciding disputed factual issues in favor of the Commonwealth and denying Mr. Albritton his right to a jury trial. We ask this court to reverse and remand because the trial court committed 3 distinct errors. First, the trial court erred in granting the Commonwealth's plea of sovereign immunity despite my client's textbook compliance with the Virginia Department of Corrections inmate grievance procedures. The record is clear that Mr. Albritton exhausted his administrative remedies under the Virginia Tort Claims Act, and he provided an affidavit attesting to the exhaustion as is required by that statute.
Second, Counsel, may I interrupt you there? This is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you about that last point?
Yes.
If you're right about the fact that him putting the level 3 request into the prison mail system, and that satisfies his obligation, if you're right about that, doesn't that mean that the remedy would be we would order the trial court to remand it back to the agency, in this case the Department of Corrections, so that it can actually be resolved? Because while exhaustion remedies is not simply him going through the motions, is actually the underlying agency, you know, resolving, exhausting, and completing the process. So if that process is not complete under the Virginia Tort Claims Act, the circuit court doesn't even have authority to hear the case or jurisdiction to hear the case. So I'm questioning you about where the end game is if you're right about the mailing rule being the most reasonable interpretation of the DSC regs.
Well, Justice Kelsey, that would be one option. It's not the one I would counsel this court to take because I think this court's case law is clear that exhaustion, although it falls within the purview of the Department of Corrections to promulgate its own regulations, exhaustion is met when the agency deems that, in this case, you know, an inmate, my client, had sufficiently met and achieved every level and every grievance under the operating procedure 866.1. So I'm not quite sure what would occur here because the Department of Corrections stamped this as untimely. Previously, they held that the informal grievance, they said it was being handled. On the level 1 grievance, they found it to be unfounded. And then subsequently, they found it to be untimely. This is a lot like the Carter versus Billups case, Your Honors, in which this court held that the sole requirement is that a prisoner must verify under oath that he or she has exhausted the administrative remedies, which Mr. Albritton has done. And moving forward, I'm not sure what would be achieved by that. If this court felt that it was necessary, it could remand on that basis, and then the Department of Corrections could take some action. But I think the more
because you know the whole rationale behind exhaustion is to give the agency an opportunity to hear the case on the merits and to keep it from going into the judicial system. So if you're right about your first premise, which is he did his part, they blew it off at the end saying it was untimely. They never really, at level 3, they never really did a level 3 analysis of the merits of the claim. So wouldn't it be the proper remedy to send it back to DOC and say, well, you were mistaken about what you said. In fact, it wasn't untimely. It was timely. So you've got to resolve it. And if you resolve it against the guy, he can refile it.
That's surely one opportunity and one avenue. I'm not sure in the interest of judicial efficiency and whether that would be the most economic route, given that the Department of Corrections has been pretty clear about their intention here. They made it clear, as the Commonwealth represented in its plea of sovereign immunity and subsequently with its on the merits. I think it's important for the court to look at the fact that the Commonwealth moved for summary judgment on both negligence and contributory negligence. So I would be hard pressed to find that, you know, a regional administrator of the Department of Corrections would now somehow have an about face and say that we messed up and we're going to go back and we will afford you relief in some way if the Commonwealth's already taken a position all the way up to this court that they believe they were not negligent and that my client was contributorily negligent. So I'm not sure if it's a necessary exercise. It's, of course, within this court's discretion, and that is one avenue. But I think the best route would be to just proceed forward, to reverse remand, and let this go back to Judge Sherritt so that he could actually review the evidence and not dismiss it in the summary way in which he has. So, Justice Kelsey, I think clearly that's one option. But moving forward on this question, just to be clear that the court's aware of our position on the plea of sovereign immunity and on the exhaustion of administrative remedies, it sounds from your question, Your Honor, that it is pretty clear. Here, my client, he kept a photocopy of everything for his records. He complied to the letter of the law with the Department of Corrections regulations. He filed everything timely, and that's juxtaposed to the Department of Corrections' untimely filing of two of its responses, as indicated in the record. And I think it's important to note that although the Commonwealth at page 13 of its opposition argues that my client's evidence, specifically this page 63 of the joint appendix, the level two grievance, that it was not date stamped. And I'd just like to clarify, of course it was not date stamped because it was never, that copy itself was never received by the department. That was a copy that Mr. Albritton made prior to placing it in the mail slot. If Your Honors have no questions on the plea of sovereign immunity, I'll move on to the next question, which was the trial court's error in short-circuiting the case and the fact-finding process by granting summary judgment on the basis of negligence or lack thereof, according to the trial court. But this court has long held that summary judgment shall not be entered unless no material fact is genuinely in dispute on a controlling issue or issues, and the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. The trial court held that the Commonwealth was entitled to judgment as a matter of law, but here, the conflicting facts are abundantly clear. This is a question of negligence, one that this court has long held is within the province of the jury, cannot be established, you know, by the trial court at this early stage when there's conflicting evidence. And just to recap some of that evidence, we have my client's own affidavit describing the fall, describing his ensuing injuries. We have the affidavits of fellow inmates, both of whom swore that the Sussex 2 officials were aware of these defective steps prior to the fall. And the Commonwealth relies solely on a case, Williamsburg Shop versus Weeks, which is entirely an opposite. And there, the plaintiff wore a 3 1/4 inch high heel. She was descending a Colonial Williamsburg restored retail establishment, and she took a fall. She broke her heel. She told the store manager immediately thereafter, "Do not worry. It's not your fault. I tripped on my own heel." So this court's reasoning in the Williamsburg case was that plaintiff's own admission of responsibility absolved the store owner in that case of all liability. So to hold that Williamsburg Shop somehow makes stair treads or lack thereof no negligence as a matter of law is just incorrect under this court's case law. And I would,
Counselor, may I ask you another question along those lines? Is it your position that in an institutional context, a prison context, that the ordinary, you know, common law reasonable duty standard is the negligence standard for that context, as opposed to deliberate indifference or one of the other alternative standards that have been used by the courts to describe the relationship, because it is obviously a very unique situation. So comparing, you know, for anybody on either side of the case, comparing, you know, ordinary situations to prison situations, and that actually goes to the first question, which is, they not really resolved any of this internally, so we don't have a very good record from the DOC on any of this. So my question first is, has Virginia Supreme Court ever resolved exactly what the negligence standard is for prisoners suing the prison establishment for slip and falls?
Your Honor, I could just rely on the fact that Commonwealth acknowledges there is a duty, and they never seem to argue that the duty is any different than the duty that would have been applicable in the Culpeper case or in the Williamsburg case, a duty of reasonable, the duty that the premises should be maintained in a reasonable manner for care of the invitees. And here, my client is even, I would submit it might even be a higher standard, since Mr. Auburn, unlike the sidewalk, citizens walking on a sidewalk or something like that in those other cases, he had no option. He's in Sussex too, and those are the only stairs he could take to go up and down to the shower, in which, that leads me to my third point, which is this question of contributory negligence. I think that the trial court once again blatantly ignored and really rubber stamped the Commonwealth's proposed order on this alternative grounds, because there's abundant evidence in the record that Mr. Albritton was in an authorized area. And moreover, the video footage upon which the Commonwealth relied in its affidavit could have been provided to the fact finder. In fact, my client submitted a subpoena ducis tecum seeking that same video footage. So that would have put it right before the fact finder. I guess, Justice Kelsey, one response, though, in thinking about it now, you said this is not, there's no record from the Department of Corrections to adequately address these issues. And I would submit that the DOC actually did. And the warden's response, which is pretty clear, the warden's response to the level one grievance, and I think that's at perhaps page 62 of the joint appendix, that made pretty clear that that made clear that the department was not interested in pursuing this. You know, they deemed this to be unfounded, and that's all they wanted to do with it. And the trial court accepted the Commonwealth's view of the evidence. They adopted the wrong burden of, the burden of proof was in the Commonwealth's court, and the trial court simply took everything that was presented before it and entirely ignored my client's arguments. Lastly, on this question of the assignment of error and sufficiency, that's entirely a red herring. This court's precedent on assignment of error does not come near the issue here. The assignment of error number 3 deals with the grant of summary judgment. It does not address the admissibility of the evidence. That's a tack on at the end, perhaps some inartful drafting by a pro se litigant, but in no way have we amended or altered the third assignment of error on appeal. So for all these reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully request this court reverse the trial court's plea of sovereign immunity and the summary judgment grant, and remand for fact finder to actually weigh these issues and resolve it by jury. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
You have 1 minute and 46 seconds. The appellee may begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Zach Lubiak on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Circuit Court in this matter entered judgment for the Commonwealth on 3 independently sufficient grounds. And as a result, in those 3 grounds, Your Honors, were sovereign immunity, negligence, and contributory negligence, as my friend touched on this morning. As a result, Mr. Albritton must identify a proper basis to reverse each of those 3 holdings before he can secure a remand. And as we explain on brief, Mr. Albritton has failed to identify a proper basis to reverse any of those 3 holdings. To dispose of this appeal, however, this court need go no further than to hold or to affirm the Circuit Court's holding that the lack of rubber treading on some, but certainly not all, of the stairs on a given staircase at Sussex 2 State Prison is insufficient to warrant a trial on Mr. Albritton's negligence claim. And under fundamental principles of tort law and this court's precedent, that holding was correct. Justice Kelsey, to your question about the duty, it is common ground in this case. We argued before the circuit court, and we argued before this court, and my friend has agreed in his reply, that the duty that VDOC officials owe to Mr. Albritton was a duty to, quote, take reasonable actions to protect offenders from unreasonable risks of physical harm. Now, contrary to my friend's argument this morning, the only evidence in support of a breach of that duty is, in fact, the Commonwealth's evidence. And that evidence includes pictures of the staircases in question, at Joint Appendix pages 45 to 48, and an affidavit from Mr. Burkhead, who conducted an investigation of the stairs in response to Mr. Albritton's regular grievance, and that is found at Joint Appendix pages 40 through 42. And that evidence shows, Your Honors, that the staircase in question, quote, showed missing edge rubber stripping on certain stairs. That is simply not enough to get Mr. Albritton a trial on his negligence claim. And contrary to my friend's argument this morning and his argument in reply, that is in fact exactly what this court held in Williamsburg Shop. There, a plaintiff secured a jury verdict after falling down a set of stairs, and on appeal, he advanced five arguments in defense of that jury verdict. And it is certainly true, as my friend points out, that this court rejected the other four arguments as well as the argument that I'm discussing today. But one of those five arguments was that the lack of, quote, anti-slip treading on the staircase in question made those stairs defective. And this court necessarily needed to reject that argument before reaching its conclusion and vacating that jury verdict. Now, the evidence in this case and Mr. Albritton's arguments on appeal are sufficiently similar to those that this court addressed in Williamsburg Shop that the same result should follow. Now, on reply,
Counsel,
my friend
what about
to
the allegation? This is Justice Kelsey again. What about the allegation of missing edge pieces of concrete?
So I would contend, Your Honor, that there's no competent evidence of that. That it is true that in the motion for judgment, Mr. Albritton makes that claim. But if you look at, my friend points to three pieces of evidence this morning in support of the negligence claim, the first being Mr. Albritton's affidavit, and the second and third being the two other affidavits that Mr. Albritton also submitted in conjunction with his opposition to summary judgment. None of those three mentioned missing concrete, Your Honor. And so I would submit the circuit court didn't have any actual evidence of missing concrete. And furthermore, Your Honor, to the extent there was actual evidence or an allegation in an affidavit somewhere that there was missing concrete, we know that's not the case because there are pictures produced by the Commonwealth of the staircase. And again, that's at Joint Appendix 45 to 48. And I would submit, Your Honor, that those pictures clearly show that the staircase in question at most was missing rubber treading and rubber gripping. And again, we would analogize to this court's holding in Williamsburg Shop, and also would point the court in the direction of Morrison Knudsen, which is also cited in our brief, which again addresses this same principle. And that principle is the lack of treading on a given staircase does not inherently make those stairs defective or unreasonably dangerous. And one way we can tell this, Your Honor, is by looking to Culpepper, the case that my friend cites on reply. The distance between the record in that case and the record in this case only underscores why summary judgment was proper here. In that case,
Counsel, this is Justice McCullough. Let me, sorry to interrupt, but help me with that, because I know in federal court it's common to position a case for summary judgment with affidavits and depositions and things like that. State practice has differed in that respect. So can we get there in the way you suggest? I mean, you may be right that he has no case or a weak case or whatever, and that you'll win at trial. But was it proper at summary judgment to proceed in that manner?
So, Your Honor, I fully acknowledge that summary judgment is disfavored, as my friend points out, in Virginia state court practice. But this specific context is different because against that backdrop judicial principle, the General Assembly has specifically legislated in this case. And by that, I mean Section 801-696 of the Virginia Prisoner Litigation Reform Act. And that provision specifically contemplates the disposition of pro se prisoner cases like this at the summary judgment stage. And specifically, that provision provides that the Commonwealth or a defendant or any party for that matter in a case like this may move for summary judgment and may rely in part on affidavits, which does touch on our third assignment of error. But so whereas it might be unusual for circuit court to rule at summary judgment in the regular course, in this case, the General Assembly has specifically spoken, and Section 696, we would submit, Your Honor, provides strong evidence that the legislature contemplated that these kinds of cases will be disposed of at the summary judgment stage. And buttressing that provision and that inference, Your Honor, that summary judgment is proper, Section 695, the section preceding the section I was just talking about, encourages courts to dispose of these cases on the record before it, whenever possible, without oral argument. And so, again, Your Honor, I think that's evidence that these kinds of cases expressly contemplated by the legislature, that these cases will be disposed of at summary judgment. And so I would argue, Your Honor, that the affidavits and the evidence submitted by the Commonwealth, and I should say by Mr. Albritton, because he did attach, I think it's north of 10 exhibits and attachments to his opposition. So there was a record before the circuit court. Now, to go back to Culpepper to help distinguish that case and also to show what Mr. Albritton could have done in this case.
Excuse me, counsel. This is Justice Goodwin. The statute allows the court to look at affidavits, but in looking at the affidavits, the standard for summary judgment does not change, does it?
It does not, Your Honor. The same question is there a material? This is the same question, Your Honor. The question is there a material dispute of or genuine dispute of material fact? And here, specifically, the question we're talking about is the breach of duty. Is there a material dispute or genuine dispute of material fact with respect to the breach of duty? And that is, were these stairs, did VDOC officials, with respect to these stairs, did they fail to take, quote, reasonable action to prevent offenders from unreasonable risk of harm? And, Your Honor, just to kind of emphasize something we put in our brief, that does not mean that anytime there's an injury at a VDOC facility, a negligence claim follows. There has to be a showing that a breach of the duty has occurred. And given that the only evidence in this case is a lack of rubber treading and that in Williamsburg Shop, this court has rejected that as the basis for affirming a jury verdict, I would submit, Your Honor, that the circuit court was correct in rejecting Mr. Albritton's claim of negligence in this case at the summary judgment stage. And again, just to go back to Culpepper one last time, in that case, this court actually sent the case back to the trial court after the trial court had entered summary judgment for the defendants. But in that case, by contrast to in this case, the stairs in question, quote, there was evidence in the record, that is, that the stair in question, quote, was like a dish of ice cream that someone has taken a spoon and scooped out a little piece of it. Furthermore, Your Honor, in Culpepper, there was evidence that the staircase was not sufficiently well lit, and so the plaintiff could not see this indentation or sort of hole in the staircase. And thirdly, there was evidence in the record that the staircase was slippery and slick. None of that evidence is present here. There's no evidence that the staircase in question at Sussex 2 had an indentation or a scoop of any kind. There's no evidence that the staircase was not sufficiently well lit, such that Mr. Albritton could not see any alleged defect. And there's no evidence that the staircase in question here was slippery or slick.
Counsel, may I take you back to one of the earlier questions about the difference between a level 1 and a level 3 review by the DOC? The level 3 review, of course, was rejected because the theory that the level 2 had not been timely filed. If we were to hold level 2 had been timely filed because of the mailbox rule, wouldn't that logically mean it should be remanded to the DOC to do a thorough level 3 analysis before the court system, the machinery of the judiciary, breaks into it?
Your Honor, I agree with my friend that is within the court's discretion to do that. Obviously, our position is that the evidence of mailing, such as it isn't sufficient to satisfy the exhaustion requirement in this case. But were the court to disagree with us on that first point, assignment of error, we would encourage this court to affirm the judgment of the circuit court on the second or third assignments, which include negligence and contributory negligence. But I would, Your Honor, in defense of our position on the first assignment of error, I would like to emphasize the reality that the exhaustion requirement, as you said earlier, the point of the exhaustion requirement is to give VDOC officials an opportunity to respond to the grievance, to respond to the complaint before the litigant or the offender resorts to the judicial system. That is the premise on which the General Assembly waived the otherwise applicable sovereign immunity that the Commonwealth enjoys against claims like this. And so in that way, Your Honor, we would submit that it actually makes sense to peg submission to receipt as opposed to evidence of mailing. But again, Your Honor, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, this court does not need to actually engage that question. Instead, this court can address the circuit court's holding and disposition of this case on the second and third assignments of error. Your Honors, if there are no other questions, we argue that the first and third assignments of error do not constitute reversible error for the reasons we explained in our brief. And again, we would urge this court to affirm the circuit court's holding that the evidence of a lack of rubber treading is insufficient to warrant a jury trial on Mr. L. Britton's negligence claim. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Yates, do you have rebuttal?
Yes, very briefly, Your Honor. First, to respond to something that my colleague said, that the only evidence is the Commonwealth's evidence in this case. That's clearly not so, and the record belies it. So moving on to the question that Justice Kelsey raised about regulatory deference and whether this should be handled by the Department of Corrections, I incorrectly cited to the Appendix 63. It's actually Joint Appendix 40. That's the warden's or the superintendent's response to my client's level one grievance. It details all the reasons why the Sussex 2 felt that this issue had been handled and was unfounded. Those same issues were repeated by the Commonwealth in its plea of sovereign immunity and in the summary judgment motions that it filed. So I do not think there's a reason to send this back to the DOC, but rather I think this case should be handled by a fact finder. And to make a point about the Culpepper versus Neff case, this notion that it was a scoop of ice cream, I think if you look at that case, it actually said that there was simply a depression in the marble floor. And this court expressly held that the worn edges of the stair treads created a dangerous situation. That situation was for the jurors to determine whether it violated the standard of negligence. Here too, a properly instructed jury in Sussex County should be presented with this case. And for those reasons, we respectfully
ask. Counsel, may I ask you one last question before you go? Did the warden address the, quote, missing edge pieces of concrete allegation? I know he addressed the friction edges, but the missing edge pieces of concrete. And my question is, if it had gone to a level three analysis, would those details have been before the DOC, and would that provide a better opportunity for them to make whatever the right call is?
Your Honor, I see my time's expired. I'll try and briefly respond. If you look on the second to last paragraph or the third paragraph on page 40 of the joint appendix, it expressly says, and this is the warden who says, a few steps in that area have missing edge pieces on the runner. So I think this is on all fours with Culpepper, where the court held that the worn edges of the stair treads create a dangerous situation. I think that these are factual questions that should not be decided at summary judgment, even where Code Section 8.01696 permits summary judgment at an earlier stage in the prison context when you have pro se complaints. Here, okay. It does not anticipate that you have conflicting affidavits.
Thank you very much. You've answered the question. Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And your time has expired. Thank you very much.